The Paradise Center for the Arts is a vibrant cultural and artistic gathering spot in historic downtown Faribault. The Paradise is committed to offering high-quality visual and performing art opportunities for Faribault and our region. Regular events spotlight some of the best artists and musicians in our area and throughout Minnesota and the Upper Midwest. Our beautifully restored facility includes art galleries, classrooms, clay and textile labs, a gift shop and rehearsal spaces, in addition to a 300-seat auditorium. Visit ParadiseCenterForTheArts.org for a full schedule of events or call our box office at 507-332-7372.
Connect and experience art at the Northfield Arts Guild. Visit our galleries, arts festival, and take in a performance at our theater featuring a full season of dramas, comedies, and musicals. The Guild's gift shop showcases unique art from over 100 local and regional member artists. Come enjoy music from the Cannon Valley Regional Orchestra or the 411 Concert Series. We invite you to explore your creativity in one of our classes. All are welcome at the Northfield Arts Guild. To learn how you can be a part, visit northfieldartsguild.org. Or call 507-645-8877.
Art Zany, radio for the imagination, with your host Paula Granquist, is brought to you by the Northfield Arts Guild and by the Paradise Center for the Arts. And now, Art Zany, radio for the imagination.
Good morning, this is Paula Granquist, and you're tuned in to Art Zany, Radio for the Imagination. Thanks so much for listening to the show that celebrates creating in stories. Let's get ready to tune our imaginations together. I'm going to tell you a story about technology. When I was in third grade, back in the 1970s, oh my gosh, it sounds so ancient history to be able to say it like that, but we got computers in our elementary school, and I took a summer school class to learn what computers can do for us. And these were the days of dial-up connections and the game Oregon Trail, giant monitors and images created with keyboard strokes. This was the next generation of graphics after the game of Pong. And if you don't know Pong, I want you to look it up. You won't believe that that's how we used to play a video game on our televisions. It was so cool when it first came out. A bar that you moved up and down each side of your screen with a controller, and a square dot that moved across the screen, bouncing off the bars. It was revolution, baby. But one of our lessons in that summer school class was about something the computer scientists were working on called barcodes, and it was like a new language for transmitting information. We were learning about how lines of various thicknesses grouped together in a box were going to represent information about products. My dad was a software engineer, and he applauded this major shift, and he understood how zeros and ones could transform a system, so why couldn't lines and bars take over? He showed me how cool this new barcode system could be for managing inventory and products. And when I started working at a major retailer in the early 80s, so the next decade, we still had stickers on our products. We had electronic registers, but we had to enter department codes and item numbers and prices to ring up a purchase. The barcode revolution was still in progress. What kind of equipment did companies need to invest in? Would this be an accurate system? How would customers know what an item cost if everything just used barcodes? Well, by the time I was working in publishing in the 90s, desktop computers and barcodes were everywhere. We carried PDAs like the Palm Pilot instead of big paper binders with calendars and note pages. The new thing back then was called apps that make the web online better. We all wanted to create a killer application, often called a killer app. And it's any software that is so necessary or desirable that it proves the core value of some larger technology. We were beginning to imagine what these apps would do. Computers in the future might not just be for organizing information and writing documents. Well, our company published magazines and books about homes and gardens, and I was put on a team in a leadership program to try to come up with ways that apps might be used to make our home lives better. Our group came up with this idea that use barcodes on products in your pantry and refrigerator to create grocery lists or to get ingredients for a recipe you wanted to try and order products for you. We thought, this is the Jetsons coming to now. And I remember presenting to the executives, and they looked at us like, that's nice, but how would that work? I do not think they understood the potential of the system. And now I kick myself. Imagine if I would have pursued that with our team back then, 25 years ago, 30 years ago. But Today, at home, I can scan a barcode from an item in my pantry and place an order for it from my cell phone in my hand. And that's been the journey of technology in my lifetime. So what if new technology entered our creative spaces? What if we never had to look at a blank page or an empty canvas again? How will we use AI machines to make art? How do you feel thinking about art and AI? And I'm super excited about today's show. The press release I received described my guest as an imagination engine whose tech-native storytelling stretches theater into the digital age. The life elements, imagination, and storytelling are some of my absolute favorite things. So it is a thrill to share the story of this transmedia artist with you. She's an artist that takes us across mediums in original and profoundly thought-provoking ways. We'll discuss her augmented reality book, Voidopolis, her TED Talk on art and AI, her project Body Mouth used to create embodied speech, and her contributions to Lexia, an AI opera. Today, in the Art Zany Radio studio, I welcome playwright, author, and award-winning multimedia artist Kat Mustatea. Her new book, Voidopolis, is an augmented reality artwork from MIT Press. She is a transmedia playwright and artist whose experiments with language, live art, and the computational uncanny articulate the absurdities of being human in an increasingly algorithmic world. And I want to welcome to the studio my guest, Kat Mustatea. Welcome, Kat.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here, Paula. It's
such a pleasure. Sorry about our technology issues in the beginning there, but...
yeah, exactly.
It's kind of ironic that that happened, isn't it?
Yes.
And I'm so excited to hear your story and share with our listeners all the things that you've done and to have this opportunity, because I think this is a topic that there's a lot, so we're not going to get to everything. But when you base it in the idea of imagination and storytelling, that is where I get excited, because those are the tools that I love, and these are ways of using it in new and inventive ways. So I'd love if you could start by telling us a little bit about what you remember about important technology moments from your lifetime. What was the technology that fascinated you?
I think the first technology memory that I have was, Ataris.
Oh, yes.
All the kids my age were eager to get Ataris and play these very simple video games. And it's funny because I was just like, I don't get it.
Well, that's sort of like, well, I mean, I heard my mention of Pong in the opening, and that was the first video game I ever played. And now you look at it and you think, this is... wow, that is so simple. and we used to spend hours doing that.
Yeah. So and then I had a cousin who was so intrigued by this that he started programming his own video games. Oh. So I had a kind of back view on how these things are put together from, and, you know, he was a teenager. I mean,
mm-hmm. But yeah, and that's one thing I was thinking about with this, that kids aren't afraid of technology. Kids like embrace it more than anyone else. They seem eager, like they're ready to learn and ready to know. And that's something that maybe we can touch on a little bit later. How did you know that then technology was going to be a tool in your artistic world?
I mean, my path there was via mathematics. When I was a kid, I was tested and found to be mathematically gifted. And so I got a really unusually high level education in mathematics when I was growing up in South Florida. And I think everyone expected me with that level of education, even in my teenage years, to go on to major in mathematics. But I, at some point, had sort of fallen in love with literature and art, and went against expectations, let's say, to become a mathematician, and instead went to art school. Well, first went to Columbia, New York, and then subsequently to art school. And then later, when one is out in the world and figuring out how to, make a living, the one thing that was really open to me was, the coming tech boom, the fact that I had a strong mathematical foundation made it pretty easy for me to learn how to write software and enter the tech world that way.
I think that's fascinating. And so then you that's really and that makes perfect sense. It's about when you grow up and what the things that you're exposed to and what you're curious about. And one of the things that I'd love for you to tell us a little more about is you describe yourself as a transmedia playwright or transmedia artist, and that's a word that's new to all of us. So maybe you could help us understand what when you reference transmedia, because I think that explains a little bit about how you cross both worlds.
So I did spend some time in theater and really kind of fell in love with the idea of theater and live art in particular. So a lot of what I do stems from that early grounding. And as you know, theater is all about people and bodies and space and human voices and then meanwhile I had this like software and mathematics background, and those two things didn't necessarily match or didn't seem like they had an obvious connector. But what I mean by transmedia playwright is that I'm rooted in the idea of telling stories the way playwrights are and telling dramatic stories. But very frequently, I'm involving not only the principles of theater and of live performance, but also the principles of some kind of cutting-edge technology, which is why my work ends up taking, it's narrative, but it ends up taking these bespoke formats. For example, an augmented reality book, or for example, mixed reality drama, and so on.
Yeah, that and I think it's really great that you mentioned the theater, because that is a place where you can make things happen, and theater is almost a great setting to explore things, new technologies, I think, because it's kind of a you expect magical things and unexpected things, or things that are on that edge of, you have to imagine and engage with it, and so it's a space that's open to that, I think.
Yeah, and a great example of that was that, I more than 10 years ago now, like 15 years ago, I had written this play about people turning into lizards, right? And for years and years, that play went unproduced because people would read it and say, I just it's a beautiful play. I just have no idea how to stage this on a stage. Like what's supposed to like are the actors supposed to be painted green? Like what are we talking about here? And that kind of literalness approach to what it could mean for these characters to turn into lizards made it hard to understand how to even approach it. But fast forward to a few years ago, when we finally did stage this play, and it was a mixed reality play. So it involved both live actors, but the actors were kind of driving these giant lizard avatars that were projected behind them. And there were like two realities. There was the human reality, and there was this digital lizard reality.
And so then that's how people can use their imaginations and engage with that in a way of listening to a story. And so it's just
Exactly.
that technology is what helps tell the story in a way that you couldn't before 10 years ago, but now you can, and people are more open to it. So it takes time, right?
Yes. And it takes time for the technology to evolve, frankly. We used a technology that was made for filmmaking, for like VFX, and that technology is not it is great for when you're just have a shoot for a film, but it wasn't really hard to work with in live performance. Like it would kind of not work half the time, and you kind of need it to, and you need it to not, clunk out in the middle of a live show.
Yes, that is absolutely true that all of those advances have to get explored and used and practiced, and even just the equipment that's necessary to make the production work is also part of that. And that's with, I think, every technological development. And I think I'm curious, when you start a new project, since you've worked in so many different mediums, what guides you to the medium for the idea? Like, how do you know, oh, this one would make a great augmented book, or this one I'm going to be in a play, or this one is a musical instrument, or like, because you've done all of these different things.
Yeah, I never really know ahead of time. The augmented reality book, Voidopolis, initially started in 2020 in mid-pandemic. I started that as a series of posts on Instagram, actually. So I just found like a fast and quick way of telling the story that I was trying to tell, and using whatever was at hand, and what was at hand was just social media. So here I was composing in real time on social media, and it was a kind of process of thinking through, well, what is that book? What is this story about? And it was very much about loss. And so when I had the opportunity to then do a book format, number one, I was interested in, could I use augmented reality on this book as a way of kind of calling to mind its origins on social media? Like, could that digital layer be there and be preserved? But then also thinking about how to use augmented reality in a way that is also about loss. And the thing about augmented reality is it's an additive element. It's literally a layering of reality. And so the fact that this book ended up having this format where the digital components disappear. I feel like I'm not describing it very well, but it was just a thinking through what is the theme here, and how can the format itself best serve the theme and the meaning. So I think that's just one example, but I guess I'm always thinking I'm starting somewhere where maybe I'm interested in either a theme or a piece of technology, and then thinking through both what is the story being told and how is that format furthering the telling of the story.
So I think that's very original to be thinking about these things in this way. And so let's talk a little more about Voidopolis. Folks, if you're just tuning in, this is Art Zany Radio for the Imagination. I'm here today with Kat Mustatea, and we're talking about her work as a augmented, or not, a transmedia playwright. And the book Voidopolis is a hybrid digital artistic and literary project. So it's in the form of an augmented reality book, and it retells Dante's Inferno as if it were set in pandemic-ravaged New York City. It's a digital performance about loss and memory presented in an augmented reality book, and it has a limited lifespan. So let's take our readers and listeners into this, because I'm going to admit to you that when I first was pitched this, I thought, I don't get it. I'm sorry. I don't understand what happens here. And I'm a book lover, and I have a hard time letting go of my books. So to imagine purchasing a book that would actually start disappearing is like my heart starts beating a bit fast. And so I had a very visceral reaction to that idea of the book disappearing, and it just kind of, and I bet there's a lot of people that can't quite wrap their heads around it. So, can you take us through the experience as it works for the reader? And readers should know you can order the book through your local bookstore. It's available. It's from MIT Press, and it starts as you think a book might be, but then there are a few other steps. So, take us through that.
Yeah, of course. So it's very much a book. It's very much a physical book. It will not in itself disappear for you. You can always hold on to that book. What happens is both the images and the text of this narrative are garbled as they're printed on the page. So there's like this beautiful kind of milky quality to the images. You can't quite make them out. Same for the text. And the only way that you can read this book that's physically in your hand is by using an augmented reality app. You can access it anywhere on the web. So you just go to a website specific for this project, and then you can view through your phone or through your iPad. You can view the pages, and this additional augmented reality layer will be revealed. And that digital layer is the one that you can read. So you can decipher the text and the images. But then the digital components inside of the app start to kind of get garbled over a period of about a year. And eventually the book becomes unintelligible. So you can't, effectively the app doesn't work anymore, and you're just left with this book you can't read, which is part of the sort of the mystery and beauty of it. I should mention before anyone freaks out that it does reset every year on July 1st, but it has this quality of kind of performing disappearance over a period of a year.
And that's the part that is so unique and so original. It's the first of its kind, and I think it's such a fascinating way to engage with a story. It takes it to a different level. And folks, I think they can go and visit, if they're looking for more information, voidopolisbook.com, and
Yes.
they can get some of those details. And that decay cycle that happens, it will be ongoing for repeated, right? I mean, this is every year it recycles, right? Through this
Yes.
time. But you can start reading it at any time.
Of course, yes. You can access it any time. It's just depending on the time of year, the components will be more or less garbled. So right around June, it's probably pretty hard to read. So you want to like wait until it resets on July 1st, and then, all through the summer and fall, it's still quite legible as a story before it starts becoming garbled again.
Yeah, that's a fascinating experience, I think, for readers, and something that just is going to be like no other book that you've ever read. And I think about what you set yourself up for in this project, because you set so many restrictions on how you wanted to create this book. One, you have this idea of the book disappearing that you had to work through how to make that happen. You have, the pandemic that I think you wrote most of it while you were experiencing the pandemic, and while we all were. And you also decided to make it a story with no ease, which is something, a challenge that has been done before. I don't think it's been done with AI. And so it was really interesting to see, and I did a little reading about how you approach that. So you set yourself in this really, I think, a challenging box to make this piece.
It absolutely. And I think if anyone's curious and they do pick up a copy of the book, my recommendation is to start with the essay in the book, the artist essay, where I kind of tell the story of how I started this story and why it took the form that it did, including the idea of telling the entire story in words that don't contain the letter E. I think for me, telling the story of how I made this project is also telling the story of how I lived with constraint in New York City in the middle of a pandemic, where from one day to the next, all of life completely changed. Like what we thought of as normal structures of going through day-to-day life suddenly kind of collapse on themselves, and you're sitting at home, you're avoiding other people in public. That would come to be an experience worldwide. You know, that shock and the pandemic would be experienced worldwide. But in early spring of 2020, New York City was a real one of the first epicenters. So we were feeling that shock with even greater sense of shock because we were the first to whom it happened. And so we had much less of a sense of how to even orient ourselves. So I guess all this to say is that the way this book is kind of fragile, and you have to kind of work to get to the story, and I had to go around all of these sort of limitations and difficulties. All of that is, in a sense, embedded in this form that the book ultimately took. So in a sense, its form, this like fragile form that it has, is also part of the meaning here. You know, it's a, I think of it as a parable about things falling apart.
I think that's so true, because each of the decisions that you made were intentional, and they were made in connection to the story and to experience that feeling. And so it's not just a game. If you, it is actually a way of immersing, the reader and yourself in the story. And I want people to know that too, that there's intentionality behind each of those pieces of it. I think another thing that's really fascinating that I want to touch about Voidopolis with you is the idea that this is so the fact that we all have this, which is the case with all books. We all have, you can have a hardcover copy of a book that somebody else has. But the thing that's different about this is we read it at the rate of disappearing at the same time, if I'm making sense with that. So it creates almost a shared community experience to do, being engaged with this book. Does that make sense?
That was something that I didn't think about ahead of time until the book took form. But the idea is, you know, everyone who owns a book worldwide in June will have trouble reading it. And everyone who owns a book worldwide will go through this moment on July 1st where their book resets. And so when you think about that, like, it's as if, you know, all of us are watching the performance of this book disappearing. And there's a commonality there to if you think of yourself as a kind of audience to what this book is going through, then you're sharing that with everyone who owns a book. I find that rather beautiful and also a little bit expressive of how we all experienced the pandemic itself, right? Like the pandemic happened to all of us, but we were each sort of individually isolated while it was happening to all of us. And here's a metaphor for that.
I think that's part of what makes it such an extraordinary book and something that you should be curious about and folks should explore and, think about, because you were able to do some of this with the help of some, AI tools. And, there are some people who might just immediately, brace themselves, like, no, I don't want to go down that road. So what do you say when people are say that they might be afraid of mixing AI and art?
I mean, there's nothing to be afraid of in terms of how you use it for art. Obviously, it's just a tool. And just because there are these new technologies that are being used for art making, image making, and so on, music making, it doesn't mean that the other tools available to us for making art are under threat. You know, we still have painters, and we still have writing longhand, and I do write longhand as well, very joyfully. And we still have acoustic instruments. Just because there are now also electronic instruments doesn't make acoustic music making obsolete in any sense. So I think it's a kind of yes and situation. It's just another tool.
And we know that yes and is one of the great things of improv, and that can send us down and open up doors and, you know, create new things. And so that should be something that, you know, that spirit of playfulness should be something that gets us all excited to explore that world. And I also want to bring us to your TED Talk, which is called What is the Value of Art in an Age of Thinking Machines? And I really want to encourage anyone out there to track this down. Kat Mustatea is the artist, and it's a talk, just a few minutes, maybe 6 minutes, about AI, agency, and puppetry, and the future of generative art making. And it's just so phenomenal. I mean, it's exquisitely conceived. It's crafted so extraordinarily. It's delivered in a fabulous manner. I mean, it's just, I could listen to it again and again and pick up new things each time I take a listen to it. So these are ideas, and this was back maybe 7 years ago that you did this, and it's amazing how relevant some of those thoughts are. So I'm curious about, you know, how you were able to synthesize those ideas down into those, you know, short 6 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, it was a process. It started because, I started to because I, also had experience with software. I was watching, on the horizon these AI tools come into the forefront before they became part of like the popular consciousness, there are all these text generators that were coming up, and a lot of people were generating text and then comparing that text to poetry. Like, is it better than poetry? Can it compete with human-made poetry? And I as a poet myself, started to ask this question, like, I labor so much over writing one great line, one great sentence. And here is this text generator that can just spit out language, infinitely. And so what would that mean to me as a poet? Like what happens there? And I came to think of, I mean, you can watch the TED Talk yourself, but I came to think of these text generators and then more broadly these AI systems that generate things like images or music, as a kind of puppetry, as a kind of digital puppetry, where we're like, basically that they're kind of these performative digital objects. Algorithms are effectively doing sort of a performance. I think I explain it better in the TED Talk than I'm doing right now off the top of my head.
Yeah, no,
But
it's fascinating.
it came from just wondering, yeah, what does it all mean in relation to me as an art maker? And I do think I'm happy to say, I think I gave that talk in 2018, and I do think it has aged pretty well,
It
considering.
has. And it's fascinating. The part that stood out for me was the idea, you talked a lot of software, and my dad was a software engineer back, you know, he started back in the 60s, and so it was really part of the beginning of how we could use software languages. And he always said to me that software is only as good as a human that wrote the code. And so there's a connection between what we think is human, right? And we put that into the code. Like, you can't separate those things. And so I'm kind of fascinated by that idea. And one line that you have in the talk is, when we make a hammer, we don't try to make the hammer resemble a human being. So it's intriguing that we have chosen to make software in our own image. Do you think we limit ourselves by thinking that computers are a piece of us?
Yeah, I mean, I'm with your dad, like, you can make good software and bad software, and it's you, the maker, you, the human, who are at fault when the software works well or works poorly, when the software, is put into an autonomously driving car and the car runs someone over, I think it's really like it's really not it's actually a terribly misguided to say, oh, well, this autonomous software is at fault and we can't possibly know what it'll do and why it did it. Like, no, I'm sorry, it was humans who made it, and it's humans. It's a very important part of taking human responsibility for when AI is doing something bad or misguided. And I think also that my talk was really also in response to this tendency I was seeing, and it's still very prevalent, to anthropomorphize AI
Yes.
systems, to tend to say, oh gosh, they are so human-like, maybe they are sentient. No, it's software, let's be clear. When things are sentient, you want to treat them with a kind of respect, right? You want to treat them with the same respect that you give a human. Like, you don't go in and try to change a human's brain just because they're acting badly. But AIs are not brains and they're not human. They are software, and you can and should go in there and change the code around if that AI is not working properly, or it's dangerous, or it's behaving poorly. So it's just really important to not be drawn into this sense that, oh gosh, just because they're so intelligent, that they might be human. They are not. It's
Right.
just
And it's a parallel to all the technology advances we've had across, the entire human history, that all of these things come to be, and they're a part of us in them, but it's not a mirror or identical, right? I think that's such an important point, because if you think of it that way, you can get scared of it, or you can let people make you feel fearful of what's coming, or make people feel like, oh, nobody understands it but this small set of people, which isn't true. It's we all share in this development and shaping where it goes, and it takes time for us to figure that out, and so it won't be something that's just put on us, instantly in the world. So I think that's something people should think about as well. You have combined this idea of, art and mathematics and artificial intelligence and systems in something that I found very fascinating. I have to tell you, I'm a huge fan of CBS Sunday Morning. I hardly miss an episode. And so when I learned that you were on that show, it just like you're like a superhero to me now. And you were featured in a segment with your body mouth. And I mentioned that a little bit earlier. It's a an instrument that engages with dancers and code to mimic language. And I remember when it was on, I like, kids, you got to come see this. This is so amazing. Like, this could change performances, the way we engage with dance. And so I was super excited about it. So tell me a little bit about this. Was part of the Guthman Prize, correct?
Yes, the Guthman Prize, which is widely regarded as the Pulitzer for new musical instruments. It's a lot of very wonderfully nerdy experiments in sound and music making. So the way the body mouth instrument works is that dancers wear sensors on their arms and legs, and as they move, they are synthesizing speech in real time. So really, each gesture is sounding out phoneme by phoneme words. So you can speak by moving your body. And it is really, it can be a really eerie experience to see it live, because I think there's a real emotional component to our own, attachment to our own voices. And when you're kind of mixing around how a voice is produced inside of the body, and putting it onto the torso and the limbs, something really eerie happens, which has been very delightful to play with.
I can imagine, and folks can check that out. That is on CBS Sunday Morning. That was a couple weeks ago, if I recall.
Yes,
And
yes.
there's also an article in Harper's Magazine by Matthew Sherrill called New World Symphonies that just came out this week. And
Yes.
it tells a little, he is really geeking out on that whole Guthman prize. And it's a really incredible way, because I think one of the judges even mentioned that, even instruments that we just assume are part of our, ethos of understanding music, like the piano, probably created an uproar when they were first invented too. And that's kind of a natural part of the process of moving, into experimenting. And it's such an important part. We won't get innovation unless we do some of these things. And do you think that's hard for people to recognize when they're in the midst of these things developing?
Yeah, probably. I think, I think all of the inventions, both for art and for the greater society, that have come into popular use are the result of somebody just becoming obsessed in their little laboratory and not being able to let the idea go and just running with it and trying things. Which is what happened to me. I'm not saying that my instrument will, have greater applications beyond myself, but I really just became obsessed with this idea. Like, could I speak with my body? And just could not let it go, even though I didn't know anything about sensors when I started it.
And I think about the idea of, augmented communication boards that some folks use when they lose abilities of parts of their, speaking or movement. So they've created ways for those folks to engage in conversations. And I think, well, so if we the what you're dreaming up could be used in many different ways. That besides art, like what moves in art might eventually make it into everyday worlds or help with communication for, folks that are struggling in some way. Like there's so many things that could happen if people continue to, like you said, to follow those passions.
Yeah, and I'd be delighted if that ever happens in this case. And just remember that for me, it came from the impulse to I, honestly, I'm okay with thinking that maybe I'm just making a technology that no one else needs but me, but I needed it. And if it becomes meaningful to others, then that has its own delight and reward, of course.
Yeah, I think that there's, and that's why we have to allow people to try those things, experiment with those things, have those, crazy ideas that you're like, what is that? How does that work? I don't get that. And
Yeah.
and engage with them. I think one of the things I heard about that awards the new director, I think that was his title, was talking about was the idea that Guthman Prize needs to be a place where there's an audience. Like we can't just be in our studios, if you will, or in our spaces playing with these ideas, but really they have success once they engage with an audience and people be able to interact with what they're inventing.
I agree with that. There's not really, you're not really, especially as an artist, your task is to, speak with the world. You're not, I mean, you can sit in your own studio and speak to yourself, but that isn't really what art does ultimately, right? It's a way of telling others what you see, and holding a mirror up to society as Shakespeare did. And that necessarily involves others, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, yes, I do have my, passions and obsessions that I know are unique to me, but I am ultimately not just doing things for myself. I'm doing things to be with other people, to talk to other people.
And that's, we're so lucky to be able to have you here today, folks. I just want to remind you, I'm talking with Kat Mustatea, and you can, I forgot to give your website, so I want to make sure that I do that for folks that are interested. It is mustatea.com, mustatea.com. So if folks want to get more information, because I don't think we're going to be able to talk about every single one of your projects. We've talked so much about how AI is being used in the in the art world, but I wonder if art has something that it is capable of teaching us about our technological world, or if you've pondered that question.
Very much so. I think that, I think one of the roles of artists in society is to critique, to be taking new technologies and using those technologies as a way of critiquing those same technologies to show us what we're really what we are really doing when we are deploying these technologies out in the world. With that, I've read my Walter Benjamin, who spoke a lot about this and spoke about how, I mean, excuse me, wrote about a lot of this. And I think similarly that it's, artists are one of these canaries in the mine roles in society. Artists are at the forefront of seeing what's on the horizon and telling others what they're seeing.
That is so true. And I believe that. I believe that's what's going to happen as we come through and process the pandemic, that there's going to, I hope there's, a big renaissance that comes through in developments with the arts and includes technology, that we can experience it in new ways because we're learning new things about being human and being on this planet.
Yes.
And I wonder if you could just close for us with just telling us what is in your studio space now, what in the space that you create, what is in process, or what idea are you engaging with?
Well, having built this instrument, Body Mouth, I'm now just working on a performance with it. So, creating a show, a live show, which I guess can be called theatrical, but it also involves dance and music. So it's just kind of hard to categorize what kind of show this is exactly, but it's live.
I don't doubt you'll come up with something spectacular. I tell you, thank you so much, Kat, for being a part of Arts Annie Radio. And everybody should put your name on their, to watch list and keep following the things that you're doing, because I love the way that you're engaging us and helping us to understand how these are just tools, and tools can help us make change and make advancements and see the world anew.
Thank you. Thank you for talking with me.
Yeah, I very much enjoyed it. And can I give a shout out to Leslie? She was right. She wanted to connect us, and I think she started something here. I'm a big fan of yours and greatly appreciate all that you're doing. So thanks for being a part of Art Zany Radio today.
Thank you.
Folks, this is Art Zany Radio, and I want to tell you that I'm so excited that you've joined us, and I hope that you will always keep remembering to add Art Zany to your life. And of course, in the meantime, until next time, enjoy your imagination.
The Paradise Center for the Arts is a vibrant cultural and artistic gathering spot in historic downtown Faribault. The Paradise is committed to offering high-quality visual and performing art opportunities for Faribault and our region. Regular events spotlight some of the best artists and musicians in our area and throughout Minnesota and the Upper Midwest. Our beautifully restored facility includes art galleries, classrooms, clay and textile labs, a gift shop, and rehearsal spaces, in addition to a 300-seat auditorium. Visit ParadiseCenterForTheArts.org for a full schedule of events, or call our box office at 507-332-7372. You've been listening to Art Zany, Radio for the Imagination, with your host, Paula Granquist. Art Zany is brought to you each week by the Northfield Arts Guild and by the Paradise Center for the Arts in Faribault.